I know that lots of you send out Christmas cards during the holiday season, but are any of you still in the practice of sending the Christmas letter, the kind of the overview summary of your year for any people? Anybody still doing that? A few of you. Okay, good, good. We used to do that. Don't do it anymore. They're hard to write. You know, it takes a lot of time. You got to get yourself together in early December. But, you know, I've always thought, and Stephanie and I have talked about this, I've always thought, how great would it be to get a Christmas letter from someone that was just brutally honest and just let it all hang out there and put it all on the table? Wouldn't that be great? Wouldn't you love to get that? It'd be hard to write that, but it'd be great to get from someone else. So just, I use my imagination a little bit. A fictional one of those from a family I named the Robinsons. Merry Christmas from the Robinsons. Just thought we'd fill you in on the year we've had. Gary's still doing the same dumb thing he's always done for work. We took a trip we couldn't afford in June and it wasn't even that fun. We think our kids are okay emotionally. We're not sure because they're always on their phones. Speaking of our children, Erica lost her $200 retainer, and Brian continues to chew with his mouth open and make smacking noises. On the positive side, they're both incredibly average in their extracurricular activities. Our stupid dog keeps peeing on the carpet. We're down to one toilet as the downstairs one keeps clogging up. We're making the minimum payments on our credit card, but we did open another one so that we could buy gifts this year for people we don't really like. Well, I better get going. Gary's family comes next week, and I'm already dreading it. Merry Christmas, the Robinsons. I'd love to get a letter like that from someone, right? Because they're finally telling you the truth. So we're talking today about wholeness, W-H-O-L-E, wholeness. So one way to describe the life that God offers to us is by calling it a whole life, a life of wholeness. And a life of wholeness is where you can welcome all the different parts of who you are as part of the authentic, the real, the whole you. That is, living the life that you actually have, rather than working to try to craft some safer, less painful, prettier, or more successful version of your life. Now, it may be surprising to us, but including the hard parts of your life, the forgotten parts or the overlooked parts or the difficult parts of your life, that will actually bring you more peace and satisfaction. It's kind of counterintuitive. And it works that way because it actually takes way more energy for us, and it creates way more stress for us when we try to edit out or block out or forget or bury the parts of our lives that make us uncomfortable or embarrassed. Much easier, actually, in the long run, to welcome all the different parts of who we are as part of the real me. Now, it's natural for us to worry that some of the negative experiences in our lives or some of the embarrassing bits are going to overwhelm or pollute or poison everything else. And so we get pretty good at carving up and compartmentalizing things, putting some things out on the shelf where it's okay for other people to see. And then we bury the other stuff that we don't like down in the back of the closet where we hope no one will ever find it. But the parts that we cut off or put away, they never stay buried. They don't stay gone. They tend to resurface and reemerge later in life and just cause us more problems than if we had dealt with them in the first place. Those buried and neglected parts of who we are tend to haunt and threaten us because life wants to live. Life wants to get out and to breathe and to be acknowledged. God's grace, God's way of loving us in Jesus Christ, it always comes to us as an utterly free gift. You can't do anything for it. You can't be good enough. You can't perform for it. You can't buy it. It just washes over you. In other words, whether you want it or not, you are awash every morning when you wake up in God's love and grace and acceptance and forgiveness. It's just yours, and it's utterly, absolutely free. And yet, it is always somewhat costly and even a little bit difficult to rearrange our lives in response to being loved in that way. And if we want to receive the life that God offers to us, we will need to learn to live with life's lows, life's low points. And so today, for just a few minutes, I want to focus on the challenges of living with depression and of living with and loving other people in our lives who might deal with depression as well. So if you're here, someone invited you as a guest today, I suppose you're thinking, oh, great, depression, that's a bit of a downer. Couldn't you come up with something a little more exciting or upbeat for today? I get that, but I hope that talking as honestly as we can about things like depression can signal an important value of our congregation. This is something that we really care about. We want to talk as honestly as we can about things that matter and make a difference in our lives. We don't want our faith to function for us as a kind of cover or disguise or excuse to look away from life. We want our prayers and our singing and our fellowship to turn us toward the lives we actually have, toward the lives that God has given us, so that we can face them with all the candor that we can muster. Now, one of the reasons we try to talk openly about life issues, about mental health issues, and about things like depression is that doing so can at least make one little step toward removing some of the shame, the stigma, and the embarrassment that attaches in our culture, in our community, to mental health issues in general and to depression in particular. The silence that often surrounds mental health issues is nothing but a roadblock, just an impediment to us moving forward and getting the help that we actually need in life. And I'll be honest, I know I'm a pastor, I represent this congregation, but Christian faith and churches and pastors have a pretty troubling track record on this score, to be honest. The church hasn't always done a good job encouraging people to get the mental health care, to get the professional help that they need. There can be so much talk in church life about joy that you're supposed to feel, come on, about contentment, you're supposed to be okay with things. All that stuff makes people feel ashamed to ever admit that they feel anything else, like depression. There can be so many warnings in church life about grumbling or complaining or being negative or being selfish that people are wary of ever speaking up and speaking out about their struggles, about what they're wrestling with, or for fear they'll be labeled or judged or something. Too often the church has said pretty naive and glib things, like saying that the life of worship and prayer and trust in God, that should be enough, that should get you through, you don't need anything else. And talking that way makes people feel guilty for ever even considering pursuing therapy or getting on the medication they might need or doing whatever they need to do to get some help. So I've been blabbering, and that's what I do every week. I want to stop for a minute. I want to hear from you. We do this interchange sometimes. I want to do it this morning. I want to hear from you. And what I would like to hear from you is, when you were growing up, so think back, what messages did you hear about depression? Sort of what did you internalize? I mean, it's not about being right or wrong. I'm just curious, in your community, in your home life, what did you hear growing up about depression? And sort of, then what images do you live with now? Not about right or wrong, just sort of, what are some of our popular conceptions about depression? I want to hear from you a little bit. Didn't hear about it. Okay, Wendy? Who else? Wasn't discussed, Carol says. Didn't know about it. Didn't talk about it. Nobody's business but ours. Are you hearing a theme yet? Okay, she said, I'm repeating this just so everybody can hear it. If somebody is down, the advice they got was just get busy, get to work, get yourself out of it. You're lazy, you're weak, you're scum. So a bit negative language attaching to any mental health issue, okay? Jane? Okay. So if you didn't hear Jane, she's talking about postpartum depression. Her mom, she remembered her mom saying, if it had been physical or visibly obvious, right? If you have a broken arm, there's no shame in saying, I should probably go see a doctor. But because it was postpartum depression, not easily pick outable, right? That she just had to make her way through it. Yep. What else? Other images, stories? Elaine. It's a secret and the family will deal with it. Keep it in-house. Right. Right. Other images, stories, messages that you absorbed? David? Okay, so David I'm glad to hear that, right? That's the only one I've heard so far, but that felt very supported, able to talk about it, family could deal with it, it's genetic, right? And they had some level of honesty and support. Wonderful to hear. Bob? Okay. He said, there's a phrase, still water runs deep. Is that what you said? So someone who's quiet or reserved might be depressed. Is that what, so, or they might be depressed. Right. Depressed or deep. All right. Those are right. Yeah. So that gets to what are we looking for or what are we noticing? Or what kind of person might we categorize as depressed? Okay, we got time here for a few more if you want to see any other messages you got. Yes, David, and then Jared. Absolutely. Yeah, David's point as a healthcare professional is that depression is a physical illness. It changes your synapses, your diet, your sleep patterns, everything. Jared and then Sherman. Yes. So Jared said there can be church environments where they kind of double down. Like if you're depressed, that's punishment for something you did. You brought it on yourself. So boy, talk about a double whammy. Someone is depressed and then gets the message on top of that. As painful as this is, let's now work on how you did to why you deserve this as punishment. Wow. Okay, Sherman. Sherman said, pull yourself up by your bootstraps, a phrase that a lot of you have heard that is can have a good sort of Midwestern work ethic thing going on, but when applied to mental health issues can do some real damages. Okay, thank you for sharing there a little bit. There's no one-size-fits-all version of what depression looks like. Take all kinds of forms, and sometimes the person who's experiencing depression doesn't know it. There was a funny episode of Parks and Recreation, we've talked about this TV show before, where the character Ben Wyatt loses his job and just goes into the tank and becomes depressed. He's holed up at home, he's not leaving, he hasn't showered, his hair's a mess, he wears sweats every day, he's learning to make calzones, and then he embarked on this claymation project where he's got working with clay puppets, and he's buried himself for 3 weeks, and he made a video that only lasted 3 seconds, and his friends are like, dude, you're depressed. He's like, what? I don't know what you're talking about, right? So the person who's experiencing depression might need you as a good friend to point out that, hey, you're not doing well. Let's talk about how we might get you some help. So Hannah Hart, this is just a short YouTube video she made about depression. Take a quick, it's only about 2 minutes, and then we'll carry on. Okay, so there's not any one-size-fits-all way the depression's going to look, but I mean, the reason I like that video is it gets at this sense of lethargy, difficult to get moving, hard to get any initiative. That often characterizes it, and I also hope that brings through when she got to the end about the little things, like if you have dealt with depression or if you've got loved ones, be gentle with yourself, be gracious and patient with yourself, and you have to celebrate the little small things like taking a shower or going for a walk, doing something small. Those are huge victories that we need to learn to celebrate together. Okay, a few things about our readings as we think about a life of wholeness and dealing with life's lows. You notice that Psalm 1 begins with the word blessed in the translation we used, but there are other versions of the psalm, and this was in our call to worship, that this, where the psalm begins with the word happy. Happy are those who. And there's some tension here, and I think that tension matters. And this is the way I might put the question. Is this psalm welcoming us into a prayerful life that's supposed to be happy? A word which we Americans quickly associate with a positive, upbeat mood, with health, with well-being, with success, and with wealth and abundance? Or is the psalm welcoming us to a life that is awash in God's blessings, whether that always feels, quote, happy or not? That question gets to the heart of what we all should and can expect from a life lived before God. Does God's care and protection and oversight, that's what's promised to us in the first psalm, does that life lead us always to happiness? That is, will the godly person, as the psalm puts it, always be happier than the ungodly person? Or is it rather that the life of obedience and faithfulness to God is sturdy, a sturdy life, a grounded life like a tree, while those who ignore God's wisdom will be flimsy, wispy, fickle, insubstantial, blown here and there like chaff? Very different images. So consider just for a moment that primary image from Psalm 1, the image of a tree planted by streams with its roots down deep in the soil, watered and nourished, fruitful and productive, its beautiful foliage fanning out and expressing health and aliveness. The tree is not just there. It is flourishing in its place. It finds itself in an environment where it can thrive. It's not laboring, fatigued, and stressed, struggling to eke out a few pears on its branches. The tree isn't in any competition with neighboring trees for resources or sunlight. This is a tree rejoicing that there are other trees experiencing the same optimal conditions for life and growth and fruitfulness. A life of blessedness might be different than a happy life. And just for a moment from James 3, for James, this contrast between two different kinds of wisdom mirrors that contrast in Psalm 1 between a flourishing tree and worthless chaff. James pictures a truly wise life as ordinary, reliable goodness done for others in a spirit of gentleness. Fake or foolish wisdom is driven by violence, by the need for more, by the murderous need to accrue and accomplish and accumulate. These envious warring desires in our hearts, says James, give rise to all other kinds of conflict with other people. But the blessed person, in Psalm 1's language, the truly wise person lives an orderly, simple, honest life with other people. I am particularly drawn to a phrase in verse 17. In our translation, the word is submissive. You may not love that word. I don't love that word either. But in other translations, it's a life willing to yield. To me, that helps. A life willing to yield. It's not passive. The one who yields chooses to do so. And in choosing to do that, to yield, they express their wisdom. So in terms of happiness, fake wisdom, says James, is ravenous. It demands to be happy all the time. And if it's not happy, something's wrong. But what God offers to us is the kind of wisdom that can yield. There's some flexibility there in real wisdom. We can welcome pleasure and excitement and delight and fullness when they come. But in that wise, blessed life, we also make room for other stuff. for life's lows, for sadness, for disappointment, for failure, and even for periods of depression. So if the primary images that give shape to our lives are images of well-planted trees and James' gentle wisdom, then we find ourselves directed into a life where we're always counting our blessings. And the blessed life, unlike the life that demands happiness, is a life that can handle lows as well as highs, failure along with success, periods of illness and weakness alongside periods of health and strength, stretches of scarcity and simplicity alongside stretches of ease and abundance. Those who are hell-bent on being happy all the time tend towards rigidity and inflexibility, and those who can find delight in every single day, like deep-rooted trees, can weather almost anything that comes their way. Now, I fully admit that we've barely scratched the surface today. I know that. You may have lots of questions about depression or about mental health that we didn't even get to. If that's the case, I just hope that you'll come see me. We can talk further about stuff that you want to talk about. In fact, research shows that people who encounter mental health issues like depression, and I didn't know this until I read the statistic, are twice as likely to go to their pastor first rather than to a doctor or therapist. I'm not sure that's a good thing, but that's what research shows. Twice as likely to go first to a pastor, and I guess, in thinking my own experience, I find that to be true. People often find me as the first step to getting on to the help that they need. I'm no therapist, I say this regularly. I am a good first stop. I can encourage people who need help to go on and find the professional help they need. And I say this because when I'm in pastoral care situation with individuals, I say this, and now I'm saying it to all of you in public, sometimes we just need permission to go get the help that we need, and I'm glad to give it. But some of you here this morning may also know that the right path for you or for someone you love is to go ahead and see a professional trained to deal with serious depression. So if the pain of depression ever becomes unmanageable, if the pain won't go away, if it interrupts the other parts of your life, and certainly if it ever raises thoughts of whether life is worth living, those are some of the clear signs that it's time to go see a professional and get some help, whether that's medication or talk therapy or some combination thereof. Doctors, therapists, and the right prescription might just be the form that God's grace takes in your life. So church isn't the only place where we find supporting and care of friendships, of course, but it can be an important and healing community. And I asked Seth to say something about why they're here, and Sean will in a minute, but I want to say that I value being a part of a community where people care for one another. And I really value being part of a community where everybody confesses their sins and their troubles and their doubts out loud. I like it that we do that in the liturgy. It makes me feel like we're one big AA meeting, and I love that. So if you're here, you can't pretend. You're here because you are just like me and everybody else. You're seeking healing and wholeness, and you want also to be a part of God's plan to heal and bless other people. So I don't know how you got here or who invited you, but I do know this. Life is full of all kinds of highs and lows, and the best way to get through life is to do it together, extending to one another as best we can the love and the grace and the patience and the acceptance that God has already shown to us in Jesus Christ. Amen.